Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and I'm here today with Music Box Massacre 4 expert Michael Kester.
That's my official title.
I want to thank you for coming by today.
You're welcome.
Taking some time, your busy schedule. So the big question everybody wants to know before, you know, movies, whatever, double feature bullshit. What people want to know is, did you do your homework?
I did listen to the last year thing where we talked about movies.
You only had to listen to that, but I had to mix it. So yeah. Go fuck yourself. Today we're talking about, this is real time, by the way.
Real time.
So don't get sad yet. This isn't our canned show from last year. This is, we just recorded this just now as I'm talking.
Yep.
Music Box Massacre 5 is coming up in a couple of days, or I don't, it's weird and time shifted because you might be listening to this next month, and which case you've already missed it, so sorry.
Yeah.
But assuming that you're listening to this as it comes out, it's in a couple of days. It's on the 10th.
The 10th of October.
October 10th, musicboxtheater.com. If you live in the Midwest, you should come by. It's 24 hours of horror films and will be
Stop
awesome.
Stop by if you live in the Midwest.
If you don't live in the Midwest, you can play along at home. So we're going to talk about what films are coming up in Music Box Massacre 5, but we're going to do that at the end of the show.
Right.
For now, what we're concerned with is telling people what happened.
The prequel.
Right. So do you remember offhand all of the films? Can you recall them?
I'm going to try.
I have an actual list in front of me. So
great. So I'm going to go through and I'm going to try to do it in order, and then you tell me if I did it right. Okay. Right. First, we had Buster Keaton in The Haunted House.
All right.
Is that what it's called?
Yes, The Haunted House. Okay.
Then we had Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde from 1930s, followed by The Old Dark House starring Boris Karloff.
You're doing good at this.
Then we had Eyes Without a Face, which is a slightly boring French film.
Okay.
Followed by May with director Lucky McKee.
Without director Lucky McKee.
Well, both.
We'll talk about that.
Clive Barker's Midnight Me Train. Friday the 13th, Part 4, the final chapter.
I'm going to assume, by the way, that you intentionally left out the facts in the case of Mr. Hollow. But
I did.
Please continue.
We also had Feldman the 13th, Part 4. Then Dead Alive, the opus of director Peter Jackson.
Brain dead for people who don't live in the United States.
Followed by, okay, this is where it's going to get cloudy.
This is about where the massacre gets cloudy, too.
So. Phantom of the Paradise?
Yeah, you got it.
Then it was Black Sabbath, Pieces, Jack Brooks, Exorcist.
Yeah, you hit them all. All right, so here's the thing about this show. Normally, I would tell you about spoilers and chapters here. We do still have chapters, so you can skip to the particular films if you didn't actually watch all of these. But we're not really going to have any spoilers this episode.
Yeah, except for The Exorcist.
This is, and I apologize in advance, this is a show from last year when we had a different dynamic. This is going to come off as a bit of a review show.
It's also going to come off as a bit of we're hating everything.
Yeah, it is.
Unfortunately.
We've gotten so much better at liking the films.
Well, we've become appreciative of film in and of itself, and we're less hard on bad films because
this
still
film is French.
Like, basically we've grown as human beings, and instead of going, that film sucks, we go, well, we didn't make a film.
right, exactly. A bit more humble then. So you can still use the chapters to skip around. The only film we're actually going to talk about at the end is The Exorcist, and I'm going to ramble on about The Exorcist for a long time at the end. So if you don't actually care about what I have to say about The Exorcist, use those goddamn chapters and skip right through. So now begins our conversation about Music Box Massacre 4.
All right, enjoy it.
So I think we've actually recovered from Music Box Massacre. What is this for?
Yeah.
Music Box Massacre 4. So we got there at noon, right? Because it was noon on Saturday to noon on Sunday. Right. Well, you walked there and I took a cab from the same place and you almost beat us there.
Yeah.
And then we stood in a line with 500 other people who had the same idea as us.
And then we got out of the line to go and get our will call tickets, which weren't actually from there, and then had to go to the back of the line.
Yeah, it sucked. So it turns out, you know, I thought we would go there and, you know, like five people would show up, and then everyone would show up at like 7 o'clock when all the big movies are on. Almost everybody, I think, showed up and stayed pretty much the entire time.
Well, I think people started bailing by the end.
I think they started bailing about 12, maybe 2 o'clock.
Everybody bailed. I think that was Dead Alive.
Yeah. Do you think that was the point?
Yep. I would have.
So no, you wouldn't have because you stayed after.
I would have left.
Oh, right. The first one was The Haunted House. This is like the 1921 version. I think there was one before that. It's like a 20-minute short, right? Do you not remember this?
I don't think there was one before it.
No, I'm pretty sure there was one in like 1913. It was like a comedy or something.
This was a comedy.
Well, maybe I have it the other way around.
All right.
Maybe it was an important political thriller in 1913.
There we go.
It's the Buster Keaton thing. Yeah. So the thing I was most excited about for this, which is not the thing I should have been most excited about, was the organ. We had a live organist. Is that is there a better word than organist?
No, that's all what right. it is.
The Music Box had a live organist, which I've never seen a film like, because it's a silent picture, right? And the first two movies both had the organist, and that was fucking awesome.
It was cool. Like,
I would say if you can see a movie with someone playing the live score, just go out and do that, because that's an experience. Trying to see, especially the first one, because there were, you know, comedic cues that relied on the guy playing the organ, and if he fucked it up, like, it's just totally off. And to get that kind of comedic timing and editing, I think, is, you know, one thing, but to try and, like, pull that off live.
Yeah.
Especially a movie like The Haunted House, because it relied on all those like organ, you know, piano roll kind of things.
Yeah, like when the upstairs hauntedly disappeared.
Yeah, exactly. And then from there we went into one of like 50 versions of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yeah, so that was the actual like first full length film, even though it was a short length film. And going into it, I was excited because, you know, revved up for 24 hours of horror films, which like doesn't even matter what I'm seeing.
Exactly. Exactly.
But you know, about halfway through I was about done.
Really?
I thought it was too long. Have
you seen any of the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde?
Worse. I've read the book.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But you haven't seen like one of the 80 films?
I've seen the one that Wishbone did. And I saw the one from
League
of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
So this is the John Robertson version. It's the 1920s one, which I believe is the first one. This became a joke, right? They did one in like 31 and 41. Yeah. They literally do one of these like every decade.
One just came out.
So this is, I want to say, the first one. And yeah, I hear you on that. And it's a little long.
The only thing that changes throughout the remakes, really, the only thing that changes, because nobody's going to fuck with the story for some reason. I mean, like, I'm not advocating, like, changing the story of an already, like, classic novel or even film. But, like, when you're remaking it for the ninth time, do something. Other than change the fucking potion. Because, like, they changed the potion in, like, the 60s, it was, like, you know, weed. In the 70s, it was from a needle. In the 80s, it was, like, it was actually just ecstasy.
Yeah, right.
And then the 90s, it was, like, you know, a fucking red and white pill.
Right, from the Matrix.
Yeah.
Right, got it. Yeah, and you know, it's a strange thing because I think people remake the film. So look at this version. This is the silent version, right? And then you had the black and white talking version, and then you had the color talking version. Mm-hmm. And I think it's one of those things, especially in the earlier decades, where people update it just because it's like, hey, look at this new piece of technology. Let's make Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde again.
Yeah.
As far as monster movies go, I think this is one of the simplest yet most interesting kind of, you know, one-line stories, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you have this guy with two completely different personalities, and there's so many different ways you can exploit that for a plot, and people don't.
I don't want to be taken out of context. I think that, like, the story and the message of the story and the novel itself is really good, I think. It's definitely something that should have been made into a film.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see, since the first film came out in the 20s, remaking the film.
Yeah, absolutely.
But not every 10 years.
Yeah.
Maybe like every 50 years. Maybe. Yeah. Maybe we should be waiting for the remake like next year.
Or it's possible that buried in the 80 remakes of this, there are good ones we just haven't seen.
That's probable too. But it's not LXG.
So just moving right along in the decades, which seems to be what they were choosing to do with their early stuff.
And then they kind of like hit all the modern stuff and then went back
then
to
they're like, who cares?
Phantom of the 70s.
It's 2 in the morning. No one's paying attention. Right. We have 1932's James Whale version of The Old Dark House.
Which is actually the second version of the film. Because it had come out before when it was silent or close to silent.
Right.
But this version has Boris Karloff in it.
Yeah. Which is the first time we're seeing Boris Karloff.
So I've seen Boris Karloff a few times.
Mm. Well, I mean, in the massacre.
Yeah, no, I know. I mean, I've seen him a few times. And he never, like, they even disclaimed it in the beginning of this film. They're like, he was Frankenstein. We're not ripping that off.
Yeah.
I've never really been impressed by him. And this film was no exception. But that being said, I really enjoyed the film.
Yeah.
I thought that the dialogue was really like cute and pithy in 30s, but yeah. like still really poignant, which was really strange considering mm-hmm. it was from the 30s. The one character with the happy, cool mustache, Pendril,
right,
really dug him and like everything that came out of his mouth.
Uh-huh.
The film started and I was like into it. I was into it mostly just because there was talking.
Yeah.
To start off with.
It's our first talking picture here. Plus, I think we were both waiting for the delivery of a Rob Zombie sample that just never came.
Well, so here's the thing about that is I wasn't waiting for that until that clip from House of a Thousand Corpses shows up.
Oh, yeah.
Where they walk up to the door, and he says, wouldn't that be exciting, supposing they all were dead,
right.
laying out on the floor with the candles burning quietly about them? And then she's like, it would be certainly amusing, which is actually like a little clip they use. I think it's in House of a Thousand Corpses. I'm not 100% sure, but I can't think of any other film.
Well, you turned to me and you were kind of like, oh my God, did you see that? And I thought you were just saying that because it was like the most like exposition by dialogue that I've ever seen in any film. They were literally like, wouldn't this be funny if this happened? Yeah. And I was like, wow, that was pretty heavy.
I'm not sure if it was House of a Thousand Corpses. I know for a fact that it's in one of the horror films that I own because I see it all the time. But then after that, like, I was totally hooked on the film too. I kept waiting for the older sister to say, you're all sinners, sin, sin, sin.
Yeah, right.
Which never happened.
Aw.
I also and have quoted multiple times, like maybe a billion since the massacre, have a potato, which is possibly my favorite quote from the old Dark House. The other thing that I there's two big things I really enjoyed about this film as a horror piece. Like as a film, it works. It's functional. I mean, it's, you know, Fargo plus, so
yeah,
score. But one thing I really liked about it as a horror film, it had a climax with a lack of, like, you know, gore and death.
Yeah, for sure.
One character dies, I think, but it's in a way that's, you know, kind of haphazard.
I was totally surprised by it. Well, I wasn't so much surprised by the climax itself, but when we reached the conclusion, and for me, like, upon first reflection at the time, and especially going through all this horror stuff, it felt really lackluster because I expect, you know, and we'll see that a lot with a lot of these other films. The climax to be death and chaos and brutality. And you didn't really get that here, which is, it's surprising. Had it come out this year, I would have called it innovation, but that's clearly not the case. Right. But surprising, and I thought that was really refreshing about it.
And another thing that I really liked about this film, I'm going to try to do this without spoilers, and just kind of nod to me if you know what I'm saying.
Okay.
There's a scene
that's not going to help our audience, by the way.
I know. I just want to know if I'm being clear enough to anybody who's seen the film. So there's a scene in the film where you're introduced to one of the characters that you've heard about for a while.
Right.
And you've been told throughout the film that this person is, like, you know, not somebody you fuck with.
Got it.
And the way that the film unfolds is such that, like, I actually bought what the character was saying when
for
you first
sure.
see him.
Yes,
I was
absolutely.
Like, oh, wow, this is not what I was expecting at all.
Yep.
And then, like, no, everything turns around of, like, 360 degrees four times.
That math kind of hurts my head. But, yes, I follow you. Absolutely. Yeah, you got a really broad cast of characters here, which, again, just to place this film, you know, in between the other films we're looking at here. I mean, you know, next up being Eyes Without a Face, and then even looking at May, pretty much looking at any of these films, you don't have such an ensemble like this film does. You follow around a lot of characters with a lot of different stories, and it almost has like the feeling that I get from watching a movie like Clue, which, you know, I'm always in search of better films that give me those same. You ever see a movie and you're like, wow, that's such a good feeling, and even though the movie sucks and you kind of have to watch it again, and Clue's campy and it's got Tim Curry and whatever, but anytime I can get that kind of sort of mystery ensemble of all these people stuck in a house and it's raining outside thing, I really love that. So A+. Well, so I mean, I wanted to ask you about Eyes Without a Face, because I kind of want to know if I think you probably feel the same way I do about this. And I have general enthusiasm for everything thus far. I don't want to like get on the complain bandwagon too early here.
I'm glad, because I have some good points I can make about the film. But overall, it was not something. It wasn't an exciting film.
So tell me about this thing.
Eyes Without a Face was this film was French. It was at the time, I guess, considered really gory.
Yeah.
Which there's some scenes that the whole audience was kind of like, oh, but I was like,
right. Well, so let's talk about the audience for a second too, because that was probably the, you know, this whole event, regardless, it doesn't even matter whether the films were good or not. We're going to talk about that because we just talk about films on this
show.
Well,
until Jack Brooks.
Yeah, right. But I mean, the reason to go to this thing, and this is seriously one of the cooler things I've done since I've lived in the city. This is like up there with like Zombie March.
Yeah.
Like I fucking loved this thing. And it was, you know, sometimes you go see, we see a lot of midnight showings just because the audience is generally pretty enthusiastic. And that's the kind of crowd I want to see a movie with. And this was that audience, like hyped up, you know, like times 10. I mean, these people, even when they were in like sleep coma, they were still like clapping at everything you would expect an audience to like be thrilled about. And, you know, applause after every film. I mean, they were really into the films. And that's what kind of made Eyes Without a Face for me, is seeing some of the reactions to the stuff that, you know, even by today's standards was a little uncomfortable. I mean, the infamous like face surgery scene.
Yeah.
I mean, you got this audience that like, you know, they start cutting into the face and you can like hear whimpering, like people in the audience are audibly whimpering and then cheering
right
because they're kind of like they're twisted and they're then the face is coming off and their like guts are untwisting and they're like hey and they're cheering and then the face actually gets start peeling off and then people are groaning again and it was really cool. I really liked that about it.
I as a film though, I'm gonna say that
it's artsy and it's French, man. That's all I have to say.
Really the only thing that I thought the film had going for it was how scary that girl looked with her mask on.
It's iconic, you know. It's got these images from it and it's one of the movies that this is kind of a weird show for us because, you know, we saw these movies almost a week ago now and we've had a little time to think back on them. And I remember feeling a lot different about a lot of these, you know, when I first left the theater, maybe because I was like going through like sleep deprivation. But Eyes Without a Face, I remember specifically sitting in my seat and going, this is French and artsy and I'm a little bored, I'm not going to lie. And now I kind of remember back on it going, wow, that had so many cool images from it. And just that whole image of the mask and how like kind of creepy that was, and really enjoyed that stuff. So one of the big draws for me to go to this thing was that Lucky, the director of Lucky McKee, was actually going to be there, which turns out not so much. He was stuck driving or something, taking a nap. I don't remember what he was doing, but he was totally not there. I was a little disappointed.
I was not disappointed, and I can tell you why.
Does it start with Clive and end with Barker?
No, but that's another huge reason. No, the thing about Lucky McKee that worried me, since seeing that he was going to be there, I was like, it was kind of a bittersweet thing. I'm like, wow, this guy directed one of like the best horror films I've seen in like the new era, which is May, which is what they actually showed. And then, you know, me and you and everyone we know go around and, we'll look up films that like directors have done because that's what normal people do. Well, people who don't like follow actors.
IMDb is your friend.
So I mean, you know, went and looked up the rest of Lucky McKee's filmography, all five of it. Every time I saw a film, I got closer and closer to thinking May was a fluke.
Yeah, that's weird.
And the
weird,
last
isn't it?
Thing I wanted was to see him go up there and talk about May and me be like, no, you're not. That's not what you meant by that.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Like me having to disagree with the
yeah,
director.
Yeah, I felt
by
this kind of uncomfortability. You know, you have built up this feeling about a director. The same happens with actors, with musicians, and you kind of meet them or you get to hear them in an open context. Where it's a lot more realistic. You don't have your own filter. Even reading their interviews, you can kind of filter through and pick out the things you kind of want.
Well, yeah,
hear
and also
them
be like, well,
say,
yeah, but by that they meant they're like, this film
there's
wasn't
more room for interpretation.
This film
there
wasn't fun to make, and then you're like, well, by that they meant it was a lot of hard work.
Yeah, right, right, exactly. Not my production assistant actually wrote the film, and I didn't credit
exactly
him. Right. So he wasn't there to defend or ruin his career.
Yeah.
So we'll never know, maybe.
Well, we'll probably know
maybe
eventually.
Yeah, eventually. I'm trying to put that off.
But do you
If you couldn't tell, May is awesome.
May
and
is
we
a
both
wonderful
really
film.
May I've seen... So at the time of seeing this at the Music Box, it was my third time.
Mm-hmm.
First time with May was before I even did any horror stuff. And I was a little lackluster about it. Not to overuse the word lackluster. I thought it was all right, you know. It had some stuff that I kind of remembered back to and thought was cool, and the cast was good. And the second time I saw it was at your place for a double feature,
with
and
teeth.
I was like way into, especially like Teeth complimenting it like that. again, so much of a movie is just the environment, mm-hmm. you know, you're in when you're seeing it. And then seeing it here, I think this was clearly the movie the audience was into.
Yeah.
I would say even more so than Midnight Meat Train.
I mean, the audience was most into Dead Alive.
You think so?
Yes.
Maybe that's what you want.
No, I think that's what was happening.
Dead Alive's
the easiest film to get into.
I don't know. I feel like, I draw the direct comparison to Midnight Meat Train because it was like the star of the night. It was mm-hmm. the original Chicago premiere. The director was there, and I felt even with the director being there, you know, that gives a film a huge boost with an audience yeah. because they're like, hey, well, the director's here, let's clap louder.
Yeah, like even, and we'll get into Midnight Meat Train shortly, but when we were watching the film, while it was winding down and like I had kind of made my final judgments on it, I'm like, oh, fuck.
Yeah,
the
right.
director's here.
Yeah.
What am I going to do about that?
Yeah, but with May, I mean, the crowd was super into it. And in a way where, you know, a lot of I thought the crowd, you know, people had come here to see this and mm-hmm. they were into it. And maybe to some degree,
yeah.
but they cringed at a lot of the stuff
like
that one
had seen the film.
Right. A lot of the, especially some of the ending stuff is, it's shock value.
Yeah.
And if you know it's coming, it's not quite, it's still cringeworthy.
It's bad. Yeah.
But yeah.
No, May gets the jump shots.
Yeah, for sure.
The scare shots. Even like knowing it's coming is almost worse.
And when it happens, you're like, fuck.
Yeah, there was, and you got me.
Well, more so than the jumping stuff, you kind of know, I think what it was for me is exactly that feeling, but I think you would have heard more of the groans.
Yeah.
You know?
Well,
that's the thing is,
longer.
I didn't, no one like, when some of the bad stuff was coming, if you've seen it, you would already be groaning. You would be, you know, it's that eyes without a face kind of reaction
yeah.
because you know it's coming and it's mm-hmm. going to be bad. And I'm like, just thinking about it now, I'm like,
yeah.
oh God. And I didn't really hear a lot of that. And then once it happened, everybody yeah. was like, oh my God. Just really quick, one of the things I like so much about May is it's kind of the slasher story, but it's got that thing I love so much about Spiral, where it was like the look and feel of it. Whereas Spiral did, the look and feel was horror, but
uh-huh.
the story really wasn't
right.
at all. May almost kind of does the opposite. I mean, it's got a bit of that in the look, but I think a lot of it is like, it's the slasher story, but it tells it in such a way that it feels more like a drama.
Mm-hmm.
And you're still dealing with, almost to the point where I almost feel like by calling it a slasher
yeah.
story, I'm like giving something away.
I think that the one of the big reasons that I'm really a big fan of May,
mm-hmm.
like since the first time I saw it. So back like around the time it had come out,
mm-hmm.
there's all this like bullshit fucking romantic comedy.
Yeah.
Where there's an awkward girl. And she meets this confident guy
yep.
and goes through hoops. And like by the end, she has this transformation where she's really sexy and she shows up at the dance in like her
You've
dress.
You got it. Yeah.
And everybody's like, oh my God. But
an
in May,
awful formula that's worked since The Breakfast Club.
But in May, she shows up. She's in a dress. She's all confident. Everyone's like, you're so pretty, but it's not for a dance.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I think the placement of that is part of the reason I wasn't enthusiastic at the time. Because you're right. That was like the year of those movies.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, here's another. This is just the horror version of an awkward girl. But this, I mean, that's the testament to this film is that over time, you know, being 3, 4, 5 years or whatever since it came out, it still stands up today. Even more so mm-hmm. than when it originally came out. And I think that's that says a lot about that movie. There was a short right before Midnight Meat Train, The Facts and the Case of Mr. Hollow. This is not something you were digging.
No, it was no.
What are you not liking about this?
The fact
I mean,
that
it's 5 minutes, it's short, and it's artsy. So, okay, beyond that.
Well, you know, 5 minutes and just short. 5 minutes and short, hey, that's got everything going
for it. That should work for you.
Artsy can work as long as, like, there's a message to be said. Like,
yeah.
The short from it was just a bunch of people that were ridiculously impressed with themselves with what they had created. And I think by halfway through, they're like, dude, we're totally making this.
This was something that really surprised me. It was made, I guess, in part or mostly by this Canadian band I know that like opened for the Birthday Massacre when I was up in Canada, who seemed like generally cool people. And we like did an awesome start theme for them and stuff. That's possible. See, I saw it and I thought, first of all, I thought it was experimental, which might just be my excuse for a film being really artsy and doing something weird. The thing I kind of liked about it is you're getting this photo from a bunch of different angles, but it's not like a gimmick where you're just staring at a still photo and trying to figure out what happened. It kind of walks you through these different pathways you couldn't have seen if you were just looking at a picture. So it didn't play the game that I thought would have been really obvious and pretentious, which is, hey, look at this photo and try and see if you can figure out the mystery. Mm-hmm. So I like that about it. I like that, like, it was showing you other things that happened in a 3D environment and not just like, this is a photo, figure out the weird stuff.
What did it
show you happening? I got nothing. Moving right along. So the reason for the evening, the thing of the evening, Midnight Meat Train.
Well, that was your thing. My thing was Clive Barker.
Well, all right. This is something that you convinced me I want to see.
Yeah.
By telling me that it existed, yeah. Really. That's all you showed me a trailer, and I was like, all right, I'm in. And then we tried to find it. What happened with that?
So, and Clive Barker kind of went into detail about this when he spoke, but mm-hmm. when I first heard about the film, like,
right.
way fucking back, before I even knew, like... like before there was even artwork for the film, I knew it was directed by Clive Barker,
produced by Clive Barker. He brought in that Japanese director and he wrote the story, but like in the 80s or something.
It was written by Clive Barker,
right? Yeah,
Who wrote Hellraiser?
Sure.
Who wrote Nightbreed?
Mm-hmm.
Who wrote Candyman? Which you know, these films are like fucking classic horror, like
Absolutely.
Rob Zombie quotes Candyman and Hellraiser is fucking fantastic up until the third. So I find Clive Barker's new film, I'm like ecstatic, especially because it's based on one of the short stories that, okay, now here's something I have yet to tell you because I wanted to save it for this.
Oh, great.
It was based on one of the short stories from his, he has a book of short stories called The Books of Blood.
Got it.
I've been reading it.
Mm-hmm.
And got to Midnight Meat Train, read the first half, and then, like, stopped reading.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah. I stopped reading when I saw the movie was coming out.
Really? Because I watched the first half of the movie, and then I stopped watching it. That's what happened.
So, Clive Barker said this was supposed to come out in wide release.
Yeah.
And I'm going to make this quick. You and I were like, yes, wide release, fantastic. We'll see it at midnight at the fucking River East in Chicago. And 2 weeks before, it's like limited release, only showing in Racine, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And we're like, we can't get to Racine, Wisconsin. Man. The only way we could get to Racine, Wisconsin is if we have like scooters.
Yeah.
And we like start.
And we seriously tried. We looked over a lot of options for this, and at the end of the day, it just wasn't fucking happening.
So we kind of had to, you know, curl up and put our tails between our legs and be like, this is just something that we're excited about that we're going to have to not see.
And you know what else is sad is, so we did the thing you do when, and I'm just going to straight out admit to this and fucking whatever. The thing you do when a movie gets a crappy tiny release and you're dying to see it, you look on the internet.
Yeah.
Like that's just what happens. And with so many of these films, because like, where else are you going to see them? You're not going to wait for DVD because by then the hype's died down. Nobody cares. Yeah. You want to know what's going on and not even online.
Yeah. I downloaded the Russian version of Me Train 2 times.
Yeah.
And hoping it's like, that it wasn't Russian anymore.
And so we just waited for Chicago. And this became like slowly at the Music Box Massacre this year went through, or last year, whenever the fuck this is airing. Music Box Massacre 4 went through all these changes with lineup. Mm-hmm. Like they were going to do the White Zombie thing and Bela Lugosi.
And they didn't have
Oh My God.
The House originally.
Yeah, right. And so Clive Barker was kind of a new addition. And when Lucky didn't show up, our faithful MC was like, hey, but remember I added Clive, so everything's okay. And so this slowly became, at least in my mind, the unveiling of Midnight Meat Train for the Midwest, really, for Chicago at least. And people there were enthusiastic, and we got a little Clive Barker before the film.
And Clive Barker before the film, I think, is what pumped it up for me.
Sure.
You're about to see it the way it was meant to be seen.
Yeah, right.
In a way that no one else is going to see it.
Because fans of film say that all the time about theaters, and I could go either way.
Cloverfield.
Like, we watched, absolutely. But we watch stuff here on like a decent home theater system. So, I mean, I think a lot of times when fans say that, they compare it to like a crappy 20-inch CRT and like a giant theater. Mm-hmm. So I don't always agree with that, but to hear a director actually like literally use those words, like this is the way it was meant to be seen, and he is so ecstatic for us because we get to see it like this. So I was pumped, maybe a little too pumped. And I gotta say, just before we even, this is probably going to be our definitive take on Midnight Meat Train, so if this goes a little lengthy, whatever. This is the first time I've ever experienced this, and I'm gonna say this is probably true of you as well. The Lionsgate logo came up in the beginning of the film. And what happened when the Lionsgate logo came up?
With the Lionsgate logo.
Yeah, the audience in complete unison, every single fucking mouth in that theater booed and hissed at Lionsgate when it came up, because, you know, he dropped just a tiny little hint of that, you know, and we kind of knew he was going to touch on it after the movie, but how Lionsgate, and he even gave the name, I forget it now, but the name of the particular executive who fucked over his release. And everybody enthusiastically booed Lionsgate, not only now, not only during this film, but...
Did they show the logo randomly?
Right. Well, when they showed the logo, I forget what film it was.
It wasn't for a film. They just showed the logo again.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that would make sense because it was the modern logo, and I don't think we got anything else that was new. It might have been Jack Brooks.
No, the crowd wasn't awake enough.
Oh, all right. Well, yeah, at some point they showed the logo again, you know, a movie later or something, and everybody resoundingly booed again. Yeah, it was great.
I told Dave about it, and he was like, yeah, if I were the guy, like the real technician, and like my friend had just showed up late, I'd be like, hey, watch this.
Yeah.
And just like click on the Lionsgate logo, and everybody would boo. And he'd be like, isn't that awesome?
Man, that was so great. And after seeing the film, I felt a little bad about that. I think you even said to me, like, can we take the boo back from that?
Yeah, well, I said that initially, but you know.
All right, so let's dive into this. What happened in this film?
It's really good
for
a while.
It's really good for a while.
And
I'm totally with
Clive
you on
Barker
that.
Clive Barker was not pulling any punches when he said it was, you know, really violent.
Mm-hmm.
And that the realism of the violence is, you know, what he was going for.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the violence was great. Ted Raimi's eye everywhere. That's all you need. But the thing that like happened is the plot got away from itself.
Yeah.
I don't want to say that. I don't want to blame... Here's the thing is, I don't want to blame the film for what went wrong.
Uh-huh.
The thing is, Clive Barker writes... That's the story Clive Barker writes every time.
Yeah, see, that's the thing for me that kind of made me sad about that.
Every story Clive Barker writes is supernatural.
Yeah.
And the thing that I think I let get away from me and probably didn't express clearly enough to you is that that's what happens. Like, without fail, every Clive Barker, everything is supernatural.
Yeah, I get so spoiled because every single thing we do for the show is, like, grounded mostly into reality.
Well, that's because that's what I like. And,
yeah.
That's what I
But I mean, my
like
only exposure
horror.
To horror stuff is either stuff you're showing me or stuff I go out and find, and neither one of us are going to pull in campy supernatural stuff. And when it kind of starts to take that turn, and you know, that's not spoiling it. I mean, that's like, I would say maybe even less than halfway through, we start to get hints of that, and then it just goes, by the end, it just like, it's running loops around itself with just how ridiculous it is. But I mean, the thing is gorgeous. The story they follow is more than just a standard butcher story of this great arc about photography in it.
The story's really good. It's just, I think they tried to go out of their way so that you wouldn't be able to predict the ending.
Yeah.
And just to go back to, you know, my roots about everything I fucking say on the show, I feel like they just betrayed you because you couldn't have planned for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, if looking back on it, there's like slight illusions, but like it's the illusion to like, not so as not to spoil it, it'd be like if you were going to eat a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Right.
And like earlier in the day, you're like, sometimes I get hungry.
Right.
And then like you ate the peanut butter and jelly sandwich and I was supposed to know that that's what you were going to do.
Well, I would say more so like I held up a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and then my hand ate it.
Yeah.
And you would be like, how was I supposed to know that your hand just morphs into a giant monster and eats peanut butter and jelly sandwiches?
And you're like, well, I said sometimes I get hungry.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't say it was my stomach.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what happens in this film. Well, maybe not exactly, but pretty fucking close.
Yeah. But okay, so now I'm going to digress and say that everybody should see Midnight Meat.
Yeah, it's worth seeing, even if just for an, again, visual aesthetic, man.
Gorgeous.
This is just great. Yeah.
The other thing that the film does that I know it's not real. I know it's one of the least realistic things you can do with a slasher, killer, anything film.
Right.
When the knives and hooks ring.
Yeah.
I love that.
I know, it's
not
great.
There's no reason for that. But like,
absolutely.
Like fucking Mahogany holds up the meat hook and like the camera just zooms in on it and he turns it and the frequency changes because you're getting a different angle of the hook or something.
Yeah,
and
right.
I'm like, yeah, that's exactly how it is when you're about to kill somebody.
Sure, why not? Well, in the imagery here, I mean, beyond just the visual aesthetic as far as coloration and camera work and whatever, The imagery here we get with the hooks kind of replacing the place to, you know, stick your hand on the train, the little loops that hang down on the New York subway or whatever. Mm-hmm. We don't really have those here.
No, but, we got them on buses.
And some of them are hooks, and like you get a lot of the imagery of the bodies on the train, which I thought would be more of like an exploitation style, like one sheet poster advertisement thing. And no, you get a lot of that in the film. And I wish we would have just kind of, you know, I want to say it's as easy as I wish we would have stayed on the train, but that's not the problem for me.
No.
We know what the problem is here, and there's no fixing it. And sorry, that's just how it's going to be.
Pretty much it.
Now, afterwards, so I want to talk to you about Clive Barker, because I think I have fundamental disagreements with you about my little knowledge now of Clive Barker.
Uh-huh.
First of all, we fundamentally disagree on whether or not he was plastered when he gave his Q&A.
Right.
I'm still going to go with hell fucking yeah, he was plastered.
I'm going to say no.
All right. That's fine. I haven't seen him interviewed anywhere else. Maybe just whatever. Yeah. Talks like that. You know, it's his fucking debut. If he wants to like take a taxi out and get drunk downtown and come back, that's fine. That's cool. He's seen the movie before, you know, whatever. He delivered a lot of the wrong answers for me. I mean, this is a guy, you know, he spoke out against the studios. He talked a lot about small budget filmmaking.
Talked about CG monsters.
You know, for a while, he was doing the impression of like Trent Reznor of like the film world. And I was totally in that, you know. I was really happy to hear him talk about picking up a lot of projects now we're at a small budget and thusly more control. And I just like hearing about people taking control back of their pictures. It's very like rebellious and sexy, and I just like it.
Yeah. Also, it was anti-Palin. Lots of
I don't know what was going on at this. So in the future now, when the show is debuting, we will have Emperor Palin, I'm sure. People will, of course, know who Palin
Viceroy
is because
Palin.
She'll be...
It'll be Viceroy Palin.
Right. Clearly be the president of the world. No, no one will even remember who that is. Fingers crossed. So a lot of that kind of degraded into a political Palin whatever, and I don't even want to get into that more than we've already digressed into.
That was really well embodied when somebody else was like, blah, 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 Sarah Palin. And then the guy two rows in front of us is like, she's easy to pick on.
Yeah, right. We had someone heckling the audience in the audience. The guy looked like Rob Zombie, actually.
They're like, Sarah Palin, ha, ha, ha. And he was like, she's sure fun to victimize.
Yeah, that was fantastic. It was all worth it, even if just for that. But Clive said a lot of things I didn't agree with.
Like what?
And well, when he starts talking about specific franchises, stuff that on this show, you know, like, okay, so we talked a bit about Hostel, where he said the first one gets it right and the second one, like, totally doesn't. And I think that's completely the opposite here.
But then he went on to say that he doesn't really like sequels.
Yeah, that's true.
And he doesn't like sequels for the same reason you and I probably really do like sequels, where...
Right.
A sequel is a chance for a film to rectify mistakes it made in the beginning.
Sure.
I think he views it as a sequel is a derivative of what the film was originally intended to be.
Right.
And that's probably a fact of him being jaded from what happened to Hellraiser.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Me having seen the Hellraiser like series, let me tell you, he has 100% right to be that jaded.
Yeah,
and
no,
the
I can see that.
Candyman sequels, for that matter.
Right. Clive being the one, however, who wrote this, I'm going to have to say he's got a lot of work to do for me to kind of up my opinion of Clive Barker. So we'll see what happens.
I'm telling you, Hellraiser, Candyman. If you don't like him after Hellraiser and Candyman, it doesn't
matter. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, no. After Midnight Meat Train, they showed Feldman the 13th, part 4. We covered this.
This is a bad film, right? Like I'm not.
I don't know, dude. You're going to say it's a bad film, but
the
ending.
Die. Come on.
I like Friday the 13th.
Oh, I like Friday the 13th too. I like it a lot.
It's
my favorite of the slasher stuff. I really dig it.
In this theater kind of gave me a different like.
Well, see, this is
everything.
The thing that solidified the fact that it was bad for me seeing it in this theater.
Well, it wasn't Joseph Zito. I mean, like with the people.
Oh no! That's what I mean too.
Okay.
Well, okay. So here's my take on this. And I remember speaking out against this on the original Killapalooza, where we covered all the Jason movies. So you can go back and listen to that. This is a film that didn't quite even work when you and I sat through all these movies and watched them. It worked in this theater, but I think it worked because it was bad. You know, I think it was the kind of thing that was like so awful that people were kind of like laughing and cheering with it.
But that's how all of those slasher films are. Well, that's
not I don't know. I don't think that's true.
That's,
I think
here's
there's
the thing about slasher films, and this is something that I can like effectively say and feel confident in saying that I couldn't say when we did the actual Killapalooza, and it's that of all these like slasher series that have had 8, 9, 50, 362, 299 Dalmatian sequels, Halloween, you have Nightmare on Elm Street, you have Child's Play. I hesitate to say Hellraiser,
sure.
But sure.
Hey, whatever.
Let's just throw in Texas Chainsaw Massacre. All of these series, like, as far as parallels go to what was considered the slasher genre,
right?
Nothing. They kill people.
Yeah.
Friday the 13th, on the other hand, fucking is the slasher genre.
Yeah,
like,
for sure.
Every slasher film that came out is Friday the 13th, 1 through 4.
Yeah.
With slightly different takes and Jason Alexander. For the most part, like, Friday the 13th, part 4, like, the campiness, the quirkiness, and the poor film, like,
right.
The way that makes it seem like it's just a bad film and an yeah. excuse to kill people and show Jason, which even the other slasher films don't have because nobody fucking knows who Harry Warden is.
Right.
You have Jason, and everybody wants to see Jason, and you have people, and everybody wants to see them die or their tits.
Yeah.
And this film delivers both.
But yeah, I mean, that's
that
true.
Being said, I'm not saying this is a good film. I'm saying this is a good 80s slasher film.
Well, the things you state here make it a good embodiment of all of that.
Yeah.
And the reason, like, I might have picked this one of all of them to show at the massacre
yeah.
as well. That doesn't, I don't think that makes it good.
No, right.
If anything, it probably does make it one of the worst because it has all of the, it just exploits all of the most awful, like, campy parts of all of these films and has really no redemption.
Crispin Glover dancing.
Beyond that. And Crispin Glover dancing. Well, that's Crispin Glover dancing is a perfect metaphor for this whole fucking thing,
yeah.
right? Crispin Glover dancing, like, it has no point in the film. No one in the room with him while he's doing his crazy trip out dance realizes that it's awkward and awful. Like, the other kids there aren't, like, laughing at him, even though it's clearly bad. And everyone in the theater is enjoying it. And that's just a great extension to talk about this film, because that's how the film is too. And then none of the people making the film knew it was bad. Like, they didn't know what's going on. The audience knows it's bad and they're laughing at it, but it's so far away from the film and its content itself. And by the time you get to the ending, I feel like there's just no redemption for what happened here. I will also point out that I was the only one clapping at Gordon the dog, which made me really, really sad.
Yeah. Since we've already covered this and, 9 other films.
Yeah.
In the Killapalooza 1 show from what is now this year, but by the time this airs will be last year.
You're hurting people's brains.
And then we're going to time travel back to the future so that I can tell you that the reason we need to cover this is the director was there.
Yeah.
Joseph Zito, a.k.a. the Penguin, was
yeah.
there. And I mean, you know, he seemed to me, like, I'm just going to get my 2 cents out of the way so that
sure.
you can tear this guy apart. He seemed to me just like a studio tool director.
Yeah.
He seemed like the studio needed a director for a film and they picked, like, the guy that will direct a film.
Yeah, absolutely.
He didn't seem like he cared. He didn't seem like he had any interest. He didn't seem like he knew anything. I mean, at one point he said, we put all that horn dog stuff in there because that's what people want.
Yep.
And then he's like, 2 things I like to do is make things come out of water and use a television.
Yep.
And I was like, okay, well, yeah, that sounds about right. And, you know, he had some, like, he seemed like if your uncle had directed a movie,
right,
it'd be interesting in comparison to, like, your aunt who was talking about, like, the last time she played canasta at the old folks home. But, like, after Clive Barker, I had nothing. Like, this guy was sitting there.
Well, first of all, you don't want to go up again, even with the things I've just now said about Clive Barker. And I don't know what, like, fucking rubbed me the wrong way when we started doing this podcast today, because all I've done is, like, bitch and complain. I really am enthusiastic about all this, I swear. But after watching this, and this is another thing that solidified my opinion of this film, is, yeah, this guy's a tool.
Yeah.
And I was afraid that I was going to have to say this on the show because I don't want to, like, speak out against a director who could very well end up back at this thing in the same room with me in the immediate future or at one of these, like, other fucking horror Never. Things we'll probably wind up at. Yeah, not that he's going to know who we are,
yeah.
but it's just like, it's the Clive Barker thing where the movie ends and you're like, ooh, the director's here. That's kind of awkward, right?
But that's a lot less awkward than, ooh, the director's a douche. That's kind of awkward.
Well, and so this is another thing. When I say that this is a great embodiment of all the campy elements in the series, that must be like an accident.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy didn't seem like he really, you know, he didn't connect with it the way, like had you directed this movie,
right.
I would have totally, I'd see it in a whole different light. It could include the exact same fucking elements. And it seemed like this guy just accidentally, like, you would have done that to, like, embody the camp in this series
yeah.
and make fans happy. And he would be, like, looking at a checklist that producers gave him.
Yeah.
And it's just, God, it was like embarrassing to hear this guy interviewed, especially to the point where they get to Chuck Norris,
yeah,
which became like the later half of his Q&A. Well, first of all, I've been starving all day, right? And I'm eating a giant slice of pizza the size of my head that was like $3. So I don't give a fuck what this guy is saying. That's how important this was to me. I was like scarfing down this huge pizza and like the sleep delirium starting to kick in. So that's about where I was. But this guy, and I don't know if maybe everyone else was just busy eating pizza, but he's trying to give these like funny little anecdotes and they're just totally like failing left and right. And,
because like I said, he's like your boring uncle.
And yeah.
He's boring when he's talking in front of like everyone in your class for career day.
Right.
But he's really exciting when your options are like your grandpa who's yeah. like sleeping.
Nothing insightful to be gained from this man Not or the segment. So moving right along. Into, all right, we need to do this. Fucking brain dead. Fucking dead or dead or alive? No, that's
dead
not
alive.
It. Dead alive. All brain right. dead is what, the New Zealand title or something?
Brain dead is the old everywhere title? Else title.
Okay.
Dead alive, brain dead came out in 92, right?
I no, got 80, nothing.
It came out in like 88.
Peter Jackson.
Yeah, it's Peter that's Jackson. What I got from it's the third of what I consider the real Peter Jackson trilogy, which is often confused with Lord of the Rings.
Right.
But I'm going to say that the real Peter Jackson trilogy are the first films he made, which are in order Bad Taste, Meet the Feebles, and Dead Alive.
Dead Alive.
Brain
got
Dead.
It.
Dead Alive, which we'll hereupon refer to as Dead Alive because we live in the goddamn US Americans.
All right.
Wow.
We've been doing the show a long goddamn time.
So before you tear into one of the best movies ever made, I'm going to pump it up. So when you tear it back down, we're back down to just everybody being like, oh yeah, I saw that at Video Value. So Dead Alive is it's Peter Jackson's third film. It is, as far as I'm concerned, ever the goriest film ever made to date. And now gory doesn't mean like, you know, gory doesn't mean scary. Gory doesn't mean anything right. other than like fucking like not even blood. Like
it
fucking
means pus and vomit.
Guts,
that's
pus,
what we're talking about
anything
here.
Anything you can think of, you know.
Mangled rodents. I mean, that's what we're talking about.
Anything you want. This film is like littered with fucking iconic scenes, fucking fantastic, ridiculous amounts of, you know, one-liners.
Right.
It's got...
You know what I'm going to do is interject my problem here because I don't want to end on that right. note. Because I'm wrong. I'm totally... Everyone I know likes Dead Alive. I don't. And this is the same problem. I watched Meet the Feebles earlier this year, and I don't know if I'll ever get around to Bad Taste because I don't know if I can, like, do that to myself.
Bad Taste is better than Meet the Feebles, but not as good as Dead Alive. But I don't know what that means to you.
Yeah, neither do I. And for Meet the Feebles, and I'm glad I saw Meet the Feebles because it took a little bit of the gore out and it just kind of like, it embodied the thing that I think doesn't work for me. And that's the like strange kind of foreign New Zealand slash, I'll throw pus in this mix here too, because that's just what you have to do. That whole element of humor or enjoyment and like pus doesn't do it for me. And that kind of like gross out stuff doesn't do it for me. And it's not enjoyable for me on like a visual level, obviously. And it's not comedic to me. And I think that's why, you know, I'm just as enthusiastic about everything else in that film. I found the characters just as enjoyable. Like you have a really awesome protagonist, especially for like, they got it like fucking dead on, for that role in the film, because that's the guy you want to go through this adventure with. Right. And this cast of characters surrounding him are perfect for this. And everybody's just play. It's like, it reminds me a lot of Beetlejuice in that kind of way. You know, you have these different characters that are all playing pretty similar roles. Beetlejuice is almost kind of the American version of this. When you're looking at things like, the execution of horror elements or of humor. Beetlejuice takes a much more Americanized version and it has like dark Burton-esque or very Burton-esque, I guess, humor. And it kind of replaces, it has gore, but it's not gore here. It's perversion in Beetlejuice, you know? And when you replace the strange, quirky foreign humor here with dark humor and the pus with perversion, I'm totally into that movie. I love Beetlejuice.
Right, because you like dark, perverse things.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. But then we go to this, and those are the two elements that I don't think work. And this movie is probably the ultimate example of those two things. And I think that's the reason it doesn't do it for me.
Yeah, well. I mean,
I still found myself applauding and laughing because
if it doesn't do
people
it for you,
are
then
into
there's
it.
Really no reason. Like,
I think mean, that's the disconnect.
There's nothing I can really say. It's not like upsetting. But
so having defended my opinion of that, tell me why this is like the best thing ever made. Because
so
I know you love
Dead
this
Alive.
Thing.
You go through Dead Alive, and So I saw Bad Taste. I bought Bad Taste before I even saw it.
No surprises there.
And I really liked it. I thought it was really funny. I didn't really understand it. I was in your boat.
Sure.
I was like, this is okay. Mm-hmm. By the end of Bad Taste, when the sheep are blowing up, not a spoiler. I was like, whoa, what the fuck is going on here?
Right.
And then I downloaded Dead Alive. I don't really remember why. And here's something that I think, like, not, like, on top of how fucking good Dead Alive is, like, pushed it to the, like, maximum limit of how good it was. That was a night we watched three films. The first two were fucking terrible. And then Dead Alive happens.
Yeah.
Not only does Dead Alive happen, but it happens at, like, 4 a.m.
Yeah.
That's all you want. After two bad films and it's 4 a.m., the only thing you want to see is a fucking lawnmower and fucking organs, like, being vain in the mirror. Yeah. You just want to see someone punch through someone's head, and you just want to laugh and watch people eat pus and see priests kick people's heads off, and people scream at each other, Singaya, cutting off people's heads, like, before the credits even roll. And then, you know, you got your tarot cards, you got your Spanish hot chick, you got a crazy sexy uncle, you got the scene with the mule and the chambermaid, and I don't know what else you need, man.
Yeah, I know I'm wrong. I know. You describing this for me right now is like 10 times more enjoyable than when I was watching the film, and I'm not sure like why this happens. I feel bad. I want to be like included on this, and I'm trying so hard, and I just can't, man. I tried.
Fair enough. I don't really want to get into Dead Alive because really part of like loving the film is not knowing where the film's gonna
not
take
having
you.
Just described a list of crazy
well yeah
things
but see the
that...
thing is like none of that's actually the spoilers
right yeah I
but
know
the thing which, believe it or not which the thing about Dead Alive is as you're watching it, it's just fantastic to see how far the film is willing to go.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And by the end, in the scene where Clive Barker said Midnight Meat Train, one of the scenes had the most blood used. I have to disagree because
most
the
buckets
last,
of blood on the set that day, maybe.
The last scene of Dead Alive.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Scene of Dead Alive.
Yeah,
what
but the last
about?
One in particular. You know what
yeah,
I'm talking about,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
So I'm not going to specifically say what that is, but Dead Alive, go see it, go buy it, go fucking... Make them screen it at your local fucking
music box
or your local music box.
Okay, so this is a really great transition to roll into the next film, which is Phantom of the
next
Paradise.
Couple films.
Well, because okay, so Phantom of the Paradise, you know how I feel about Dead Alive because this is a movie that both of us watched and we were kind of like, what?
Yeah.
We didn't really know what was going on.
Let's
here.
Take a step back here before we get into the film.
Sure.
To kind of reevaluate where we are in the course of the massacre.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's sleeping. And it's Dead Alive was the midnight show.
Yeah.
If I were, you know, I can't actually put myself in these shoes.
Right.
But if I were 35, you know, engaged, had a day job, fucking, you know, was out to the bar earlier, going out to the bar later, whatever. The massacre for me would have happened from 7 to midnight.
Yeah.
Which, you know, take it or leave it.
Well, that, clearly the placement of the movies at those times was not
right. That's what I mean.
Got it.
That's what I mean. Is so the midnight show was Dead Alive. Mm-hmm. Everybody was fucking pumped for Dead Alive.
Mm.
Dead Alive ends, and then that, I think that is what we can.
That was the end of the crazy applause.
From here on, consider the last leg of the massacre.
Right.
And last leg for two reasons. Because people were passing out, leaving, or shouting obscene things that didn't make sense anymore, including myself. And
we will get to that.
And last leg because they were running out of films.
Yeah.
I really like Pieces. I really like Jack Brooks. But other than that, like, there's five films left, and two out of five
is
not good.
Well, so this is the last leg, unless you count the, like, fanboy erection that is The Exorcist.
Yeah.
Which you were glad enough to,
Only the MC was excited about.
Turns out, watching that film, and we'll hit this, but people in the theater loved it. They must have just been asleep. I don't know. Whatever. We'll get into that when it happens. But there is a reason people, I think, stuck around until the very end of this thing. Phantom of the Paradise is a movie we watched. It's from 1974. It's an apparent cult classic. I mean, so I dabble in the cult classic stuff here and there. Rocky Horror was like one of my first big
Rocky Horror film got cult classic things. Right.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. I don't, you know, there was no charisma for me anyways in Phantom of the Paradise. You know, I get the joke. I understand Phantom of the Opera, haha, and this guy, he writes all the music and he stars in, you know, like, well, I get all that.
Here's the thing about Phantom of the Opera that, or sorry, Phantom of the Paradise, that I'm going to just say because I really don't have a whole lot more to say about it. Phantom of the Paradise is this weird thing that happened in the 70s where they took three stories that had been written fucking 100 years before, put them all in the same story, and then had, like, silly actors play them out.
Right.
Like, they had fucking Weird Al Elfman as the main character.
Yeah.
And then the leprechaun.
Got it.
As the other guy. And, I mean, granted, Jennifer Harper, who played Phoenix in the film, I've not really seen her in a film I like, but she's really pretty.
All right.
I think.
Here's what confuses me about this, with the cult classic thing. And I guess this applies to all cult classics, so maybe it's just something I don't understand yet. Maybe I need to go on, like, cult classic boot camp, like I went on horror boot camp this year, and then maybe I can, like, report back in and tell you what the fuck happened, because I don't know. So I could understand if you were a kid in 1974 and this was playing at the local, like, fucking double feature, chop shop, whatever thing, and you went and saw it, like, every Saturday night, like, wore drag and did the Rocky Horror kind of cult classic thing. But there were kids there our age who were super into this.
Yeah.
It wasn't like 70s, like, burnout. No one was 45 and going to this thing. I mean,
this was when Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde was in its fifth remake.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And instead, people are seeing Phantom of the Paradise.
Yeah, and
which
I
makes
just,
sense.
Right.
But now at the massacre, when, like,
why are people
be,
there? Why are they in costume? Yeah. Why? I just don't understand. If you understand, doublefeatureshow.com, click contact. Send us a thing. I just want someone to please explain this thing to me. So this is when we enter into the dark period of Music Box Massacre 4.
By the dark period, you mean the Black Sabbath?
Black Sabbath. So let me set the mood for this here, right? We pass Midnight Meat Train, which is the big, you know, the big, like, come to this unveiling thing of the night. And we move straight into Dead Alive, which is the, like, hey, if you're up at midnight, you apparently like Dead Alive. If you're up at midnight and not Eric from Double Feature, you enjoy Dead Alive. And everybody's super into it. And once you get to Phantom of the Paradise, I believe that is the point where you're either in this for the long haul or you watch the first 20 minutes and go, Juicy Fruit, I'm fucking out of here.
Yeah.
So I think by the time you get to Black Sabbath, everyone, the Phantom of the Paradise people were done. Everybody who had lost interest had left. And there was a point where, like, we were kind of starting to lose it.
You and Laura were starting to lose it. I was just egging you on.
Yeah, fucking cool hand Luke over here. All right, I got it. You tap me on the shoulder and you go, hey, turn around. And I'm like, uh-oh, what the fuck? And after watching Phantom of the Paradise, I'm expecting, like, Black Sabbath, the band, to be, like, watching this, or someone in an elaborate costume of, like, a giant, like, gory baby or a slice of pizza with three heads. I don't know what's going to be behind me. But I enter into this Twilight Zone moment, which is one of the most surreal moments I've had in my entire existence, where we are now in a huge theater. Anyone listening to this who's been to the Music Box, this is the biggest theater I think I've ever been in. The, you know, it's a gigantic room. There's hundreds of people in this thing. I turn around and literally everyone is asleep, like heads hanging over, drooling. I mean, they're emitting this sound like when you're alone in your apartment and the compressor from the refrigerator kicks on.
Yeah.
I mean, it was the creepiest, like, and, you know, Black Sabbath is, like, as, like, Lynchian as, you know, the Music Box Massacre got. It was kind of bizarre. You know, telephones are ringing. You get the
first segment of Black Sabbath scared me.
Well, you get the whole, like, weird Boris Karloff thing coming back. And I turn around and these people are all asleep. We're, like, the only, there were maybe, let's say there's 200 people there, 10 are awake. Yep. Like, literally. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not even fucking kidding. I could not see other awake people. I'm assuming it's, like, five of us and, like, two or three people on the other side of the theater I can't see. And I'm starting to lose it because I got 5 hours. We all got 5 hours of sleep the night before. I don't know how the fuck that happened, but no one got any sleep before we did this thing. We're now into, like, this is like 4 or 5 a.m. This is past the midnight kids. I mean, everybody, but we're committed. We're committed to staying up and watching these things. And I could not tell you one thing that happened during Black Sabbath aside from answer your telephone.
Yeah, so I'm just going to cap Black Sabbath real quick here because I was awake and not giggling at Ghost Cold.
Adam Lorraine Warren have prompted me to giggle at Ghost Cold, which I had to bring up every 5 seconds, or Cute Dog, yeah. which was, I have no idea what was happening during that film. We were losing our minds.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there was definitely a point in time where I started, where I started saying that all the horses in the film were the cutest dogs ever.
Right.
And I also,
if this doesn't make sense to you, it didn't make any fucking sense to us either.
Also, I think it was during Pieces, but it might've been during Black Sabbath. Mm. And you made the comment that you wish more people were awake, but right. someone like a girl showed up with no shirt on, everyone's like, woo!
Yeah.
And by that time, I'm so sick of everybody doing that. I'm just like, women are not objects.
Right. And like the six people awake were like, I don't get it.
Yeah.
It was so bizarre. I mean, we're just in, I don't know what happened in Black Sabbath. I'll see it again. It looked like I felt like I watched a trailer for it and not the entire film. It's these three shorts, and we saw the American version, not the Italian one, which give or take that. I mean, the Italian version, if you're going to look at this as a legitimate film, I think you have to go Italian version. It's scarier. There's like weird lesbian subplots. There's all this shit going on in it. The American version has Boris Karloff speaking to the audience in these weird campy, like they look like the kind of the trailers that the Music Box had going between the films, or like the fake thank you for not smoking, don't talk during the movie things they had going. But it was so surreal, and I'm like, my mind was blown. I felt like what people who do drugs probably feel like. And we were so loud and so obnoxious that we'd been trying to like keep our quiet and be respectful and enthusiastic of the films, because you don't want to be that asshole. Mm-hmm. But we're in a room full of like 200 or 300 sleeping people, and we couldn't wake them up even with our shrill shrieking, giggling, and Ghost Cold.
Yeah. So
I have no idea what
Black
happened.
Black Sabbath happened, because, you know, that happens. It really happens. But then we moved on into... So, okay, again, digressing into The Massacre. Mm-hmm. After Dead Alive, Rusty Carrot Top came out and was like, hey, we've got more movies. And like, some people are like, okay. And he's like, Phantom of the Paradise is next. Big cheer.
Yeah.
Black Sabbath is after that. Pretty big cheer.
Yeah.
Pieces is next. Three people cheered.
Right.
Jack Brooks is next. I cheered.
You cheered. And I was like, this guy over here, really excited.
And then he's like,
you were literally the only person in this theater who gave a fuck about this movie.
And then The Exorcist.
Yeah.
And some people cheered.
I mean, Black Sabbath is this kind of film. I always hear Quentin Tarantino going on and on about it. Not that he doesn't do that about, like, he probably owns every single one of these films. I'm sure he puts this massacre on for himself, like, every weekend. But I was like, all right, I got to pay attention to this because it's relevant somehow, right? And we move into Pieces. And, like, I know you've never had this experience because you've never been, like, wasted off your ass. But there was a time in my life where I did that. And you get to this point when you are complete, and I'm trying to appeal to my audience to, because you understand being insomnia, like, off your ass. So let me explain to you what it's like to be wasted, and to our wasted audience what it's like to, like, have stayed up for, like, 30 fucking hours. You get to a point where you are obnoxiously drunk, and you know you're being obnoxious and people are looking at you, so you decide the only way to save yourself, because you're saying all these things that are fucking hilarious because you're wasted, and you're like, wow, I'm so funny and charming and everybody at the party loves me. And then you get to a point where you're the only person in the room talking and you're so loud and everyone's staring at you, so you go, all right, that's it, I'm not talking anymore. You're just like, that's it, I'm done. Shh, no talking, Eric. You're just going, shh, keep quiet to yourself. And Pieces came on, and I was like, people are starting to wake up. And I should make this really clear. I was not wasted. I was fucking tired, right? But I was like, all right, people are going to be staring at me. This is how I'm going to get through the rest of the massacre without being delirious. I'm just not going to say a word. Mm-hmm. And I went into my little quiet mode, and I refused to say anything, and I got through Pieces. And Pieces is something we really should have just artificially inserted into the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Yeah.
So Pieces came out around the same time as the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But the difference between Pieces and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is that Pieces is good. Pieces is it's a whodunit mystery.
Great. I'm there.
But the way it's done as a whodunit mystery is like in the most campy, obvious, shitty way.
Right.
Where there's the Scooby-Doo, like, that's the obvious guy because he's big and bulky and has a stink eye.
Well, hold on. Andy's the guy who, he's like the lumberjack.
Yeah, he has
a
chainsaw. He's the chainsaw guy.
Yeah.
And then there's...
It was like the fake trailer they showed with the werewolf in the wheelchair.
Right. And then there's the other guy. Then there's the other guy who's like uncomfortable with people and lives alone, or like lives with his mom, and he just like, he keeps to himself and he doesn't want like any... anything to do with anyone.
Right.
Pieces and May have a lot in common in that there's the whole, like, building, whatever, perfect thing. There's really not a whole lot I can say about Pieces without spoiling it, other than...
We haven't dropped... Will you allow me to... Because I know you're a Pieces enthusiast, but you don't have to go to Texas to have a Chainsaw Massacre.
You don't have to go to Texas to have a Chainsaw Massacre.
That's just, that's it right there. That's... Do we need to say anything else?
That's the tagline to Pieces right
there. It's everything. It's all of the great elements. Mm-hmm. It's the self-awareness of Friday the 13th Part 4, the final fucking chapter. Yeah. That's it. And it's where it's the place, really, that Texas Chainsaw Massacre never went. In very much the same way as when we did the Terminator movies and you talked about how Sarah Connor never understood that everyone else was just having like a fucking ball and just laughing their asses off, and she was like, I'm going to kill the machines.
Yeah.
Like Texas Chainsaw Massacre is that series that takes itself so seriously and you're like, come on guys.
Yeah.
There just needs to be chainsaws and Dennis Hopper singing a song and tits and that's it. Yep. And that's what Pieces does.
Yeah, without Dennis Hopper, unfortunately. But what Pieces does have is... unsportsmanlike haymakers and one fantastic scene that results from simply bad chop suey that
That is the greatest thing in the entire film.
I don't want to spoil what happens here.
Don't,
because
please don't.
This is something that you really have to see to believe. What I'm just gonna say, because you'll know watching Pieces, you'll know when this happens. The director of Pieces was making another film of another genre at the time and decided to hold over one of his actors to do a short scene in Pieces.
Right.
Very short, very pointed, but I'm sure you'll be able to pick it out.
Right.
So that's Pieces. Pieces is fun. Pieces is good.
This is one of the most what the fuck scenes in like cinematic history. I don't think I've ever seen. This is like something that like The Happening accidentally does. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like, I mean, it is so bizarre, and it's like it's at exactly the right point in the film, and it's just it's fantastic.
So can we?
We move from the six people who are excited for Pieces
into my movie
down to Jack Brooks, which you wrote and directed. Is that what happened?
I wrote, directed, and starred in as Robert England. Robert. Fucking England.
Thank you.
So Jack Brooks' Monster Slayer came out this year, which is last year for you.
My head is still hurting.
It was really, really, really mixed reviews.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people said it wasn't horror. A lot of people said it was too slow.
Right.
A lot of people said it was like the greatest thing, one of the most refreshing things that have ever come out. And me, like, wanting to be excited for The Massacre, I refrained from seeing it. It was out on DVD, like, 2 weeks before The Massacre.
It's another one of those that hit the internet about the same time as theaters.
And I was like, I need to see this. And
pull
I was
the
like,
weasel,
no,
man.
I'll wait. So I went and I waited till 7:45 in the morning.
Yep.
When they show Jack Brooks' Monster Slayer just for me.
Which is the reason you were still there.
Yep.
You would have been out after, probably after Dead Alive, right?
No, I would have stayed because I hadn't seen the other films.
Right, all right.
I would have probably stayed for Pieces. But Jack Brooks, which I loved going into it and you loved coming out of it.
Yeah.
Well, I also loved coming out of it, not to say that I lost interest.
Right,
in it.
Right.
Jack Brooks is it's a weird pick for the Massacre.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue that it's barely horror, but it has Robert Englund, so it's actually horror.
Yeah.
It's one of the few...
I think by definition, Robert Englund is in it, it's horror. Done. Mm-hmm. End of argument.
Jack Brooks is funny.
Mm-hmm.
It's really funny, and the whole premise is there's this guy who has like rage issues, who can't figure out how to control his rage issues. It kind of does the same thing Gremlins does, where when it goes into his history, it's like... Yeah, his family was eaten by a monster when they were camping.
Yeah. Yeah, it sets you up immediately in this alternate world where monsters exist. Mm-hmm. It's a very RPG thing to me, right? You look at a lot of classic... I hate to, like, draw obscure video game... No, I'm lying. I love drawing obscure video game comparisons. Anyone who's ever played Earthbound, the three people in our audience listening to this who've played that, where it's like, hey, it's just like every day and you go to the convenience store and you get money out of the ATM. Oh, but there's monsters.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly how this movie is. It's like, this is exactly like today, except there's monsters. And this is a movie... I was pumped for this too, but I was like trying not to be pumped because I didn't want there to be two people who wanted to see this film. I wanted it to just be you because that was way fucking funnier to me at the time. And we go into this and I almost forgot that Robert Englund was in it. And as soon as I saw that, I was like, oh man. But I think you absolutely fucking nailed it when you were like, when you told me, you know, this is what The Faculty could have been. And I mean, The Faculty's great for the time and place it was at, and it's this weird, strange piece of Robert Rodriguez history.
Robert fucking Rodriguez.
But this really, it's the parallels here are uncanny. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a great take on that very, very specific kind of genre. And this movie hits all the core elements, but not even, you know, where Pieces did the ancient, what, 70s, 80s kind of like self-aware piece of this. Jack Brooks kind of puts a new spin on a lot of that stuff. You know, I think the ultimate shining moment of that was, again, this thing that only you and I were excited for, which was Death Curse.
Yep. Going back again, diving back into the Jason series, but more over diving back into horror films from the '80s.
Mm-hmm.
Death Curse is a contingent character that you fucking need.
Yeah.
In every
apparently
movie
need
where you have the character who's trying to figure out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
The new cop in town. The yep. The kid that just moved to town.
You got it.
Whatever. Whoever this is, the person who's in search of their like lost sister who died in the previous sequel, whatever that may be, they go to this town and they go into the local bar. They go into the local police station. They find the local crazy man on a bike, which is my personal favorite.
Yep.
And they go, I need to find Camp Blood. I need to find this house at the end of Front Street. I need to find fucking Elm Street. I need to find the doll. Or I need to find the death place of Charles Lee Ray. I need to find the magic puzzle box. I need to find Michael Myers' home in fucking Haddonfield, Illinois. And without fail, a character goes, and I'm going to do it in character.
Please.
Because I'm so used to doing it in Please. Character. The character goes, don't go there.
There's a death curse!
Yep, that's it.
And Jack Brooks delivers.
Yeah.
Except in a new way, where Jack Brooks is like, I need to go plumb this house.
Right, exactly.
And
exactly.
The guy, the old man that works at the hardware store is like, don't go up there.
There's a death curse.
Well, and so the thing that made this like even fucking funnier than, I'm trying to hold back like the insomnia giggles on this podcast right now. But you and I sitting there in anticipation, like fucking like, Thelma and Louise like, about to go off the fucking cliff.
Fist clenched, just like,
we're both
on,
going, we see the old guy, right? Yeah. We see delirious old man. He's behind the counter. Fucking Jack Brooks is there. And you and I are both like, under breath, we're like, death curse, come on. Gotta be a death curse. It's gonna be a, do it, do the death curse, do it, here it comes. And it's building, and we're like, oh, the whole audience is just, this is gonna be uproarious. Everyone is gonna, and we're both like, death curse, come on, here it comes, death curse. And he's like,
you have a death curse.
And both of us scream at the top, almost like standing ovation is how I remember it in my mind.
Like, yes!
I believe we like pull a fucking Rocky off our like seats, and we're the only two.
Yeah,
everybody. No else one is, else is excited.
Like, everybody
for
else in the audience like looks from the screen and snaps to that side of the theater, and they're like,
"Why are
what?
Those two so excited? Death curse! Come on, guys, what happened? Yeah. Like, are people asleep? What's it? Why did the theater miss out on this?
I don't know.
I want to jump immediately, and maybe we'll do Jack Brooks in a show, and who fucking knows what year two holds in store? Except everyone already listening to this, and not the hosts. But so you bailed at this point after Jack Brooks.
Yeah.
Well, you were it's gone.
I would like to rephrase that. And instead of saying bail, which you can totally say because you stuck it out, I'm going to say I amiably withdrew.
All right. That's acceptable. You put in your resignation.
Because whereas bail would mean like, I'm too tired, I can't do this.
Right.
I was sitting in the theater literally going through my mind, I could watch The Exorcist or sit on my couch.
Or you could do literally anything else
and,
in the world.
So instead
I do not resent you for the decision you made.
Instead of watching The Exorcist, I decided to go home and sit on my bed and eat some goldfish.
And then watch Dead Alive again, which tells you something about that. So I sat through The Exorcist, and I wanna brief you about, and anyone listening to this who didn't go last year or wants some fond memories, about what happened in the bizarre period between Jack Brooks and The Exorcist. So after we saw Robert Englund as Jabba the Hutt, which was pretty fantastic, there was basically no cheering. People were like, that was a film, I guess. They Fargoed fucking Jack Brooks. Can you believe that shit? And so our MC gets up there, and he's like, hey, we're all tired. And they're handing out prizes. Fucking people are giving jokes. And it's like, does anyone know a good joke? Anybody read any good books? Like, they're trying to put together a reel of trailers to show before The Exorcist. And so people are hanging around. So they either want to just say, look, I made it through, or they really love The Exorcist. And so now I'm in a theater full of people who didn't like Jack Brooks. So I'm already like, man, this is going to be difficult. And we're at the point where we're telling jokes, all of which are atrocious. Mm-hmm. So we're sitting here for like 45 minutes waiting on The Exorcist. Anticipation is building because I've never seen The Exorcist. And I can totally understand why you took off here.
Yep.
I sit through The Exorcist. And I just want to touch on The Exorcist briefly because we're never going to talk about this on the show ever. The Exorcist is, and I say, you know, sometimes I will admit that I misunderstand a film. Sometimes I'm overenthusiastic about films, probably most times, right? I mean, if you'll listen to the history of the show, I appear to have even liked Alex G. And, you know, sometimes I just don't get it. The Exorcist, no one gets but me. That's what happens with The Exorcist. And apparently Jack Brooks. I don't know what's going on there. I will even submit that maybe I'm wrong about Jack Brooks. Jack Brooks, maybe it's just awful and I just don't understand. Mm-hmm. But The Exorcist is a film that I don't even know if I'd consider this thing a film. This thing is a train wreck. It's an atrocity against man. And even though I didn't see it, you know, the day it came out in theaters and I don't have the like nostalgia and whatever the fuck happened, I don't know if that was just a boring weekend for film or why this thing took off, but this is like the worst thing that ever happened. And not even necessarily that it's boring, just this film cheats. It's everything I hate about horror. Like, if there was one thing that would make me just throw up my hands and quit this whole fucking, like, train ride right here, I would just be like, bam, Exorcist. I'm done with horror. I'm out. I've given up on horror. This is a movie that I do not understand the enthusiasm for. And not in a Phantom of the Paradise way. Because I see those kids and I go, oh, they're funny and this is a cult and whatever. Okay, cult classic. The Exorcist is just, it cheats. This is a movie that is billed as the most horrifying film of all time, right? And it's not a horrifying film. It's a film that startles you. A film that horrifies you stays with you, right? And this is, you know, this is the comparison I will now make with The Exorcist, and for all time, this will be what this is. You have films that psychologically damage you for, you know, weeks. You have films that leave you. I remember us seeing 28 Weeks Later. That was a film that, while most of it was kind of, it was scare tactics, it startled you and whatever, it did kind of make you leave the theater and feel creeped out.
Well, Cloverfield too.
Cloverfield had the exact same impression. Especially, you know, that whatever, let's not launch into Cloverfield. But yeah, absolutely, same feeling. And you get a lot of these movies, and I know I always throw Requiem for a Dream in that camp. Funny Games did the same thing to me where I watched it and I was like, I feel kind of weird right now. And it haunts you in a very strange kind of way. The Exorcist uses really, really cheap film techniques, which are basically never even copied again in film, right? With that age-old saying, of course, about imitation being the most sincere form of flattery, no one even really bothers to steal these techniques in film ever again because they're so cheap, they're so deliberate, they're so obvious. Here's a film, first of all, and I need to talk about the ending, but I'm going to do it at the very end of the show. So this is a film, let me just get the worst gimmick, like, off my chest first. This is a film that randomly inserts frames of ghost faces. I'm trying not to launch back into Ed and Lorraine Ghost Cold here. I'm trying really, really hard. But you will randomly get demon faces for no reason. Like, someone opens a door, they know where your eyes are on the screen. You want to know what's behind the door. They just show you a scary face. You know, it's like, it's basically what, like, fucking Something Awful or Something Rotten or whatever the hell that website was did with like flash animation, where they're like, here, stare at this, and then they show like a person shrieking and you're supposed to like jump out of your chair. That's what that YouTube, man, this is like YouTube decades before it existed, like the worst of YouTube. If I had seen a skateboarding dog in this film, I would have been so much happier.
All right, so I was planning on not saying anything, but I have to interrupt you real quick. I mean, I had left, so I didn't know this, but apparently they showed you the redone 2000 version.
Yeah, right.
Because the original version did not have the scary ghost YouTube faces.
And Han shot first. Look, I understand. All right, so I saw the new 2000 butchered version with the frame-by-frame inserts, and you can't, you know, I guess I'm not going to hold the film to task for that because, whatever, we've seen that in countless cases before where films have been revised decades later, and I don't want to get into that. But I think that's still a fair complaint to lobby against the film because it's very representative of the other things that I think this film does. You know, people call this the most horrifying film of all time, and I don't think that's true. I think this is the most maybe startling or jump-worthy film of all time. You know, The Exorcist is a film that it doesn't stick with you in the way that, you know, let's just look at something from the show. Like Spiral last year. I know I drag out Requiem for a Dream all the time as something that psychologically disturbs me, and even parts of May from this festival. I mean, those are images that really stay with me because there's stuff that rather than just making me jump, it slowly creeps under my skin and it stays there and it's impossible to scrub away. The Exorcist, rather, is a collection of boo moments. It's, you know, someone sneaking up behind you and tapping you on the shoulder unexpectedly. And I don't know if there's any real credit to be given for that. I mean, obviously, the film has had iconic imagery that's lasted over the decades, and people still look back at a lot of, you know, what the little girl does and a lot of the pieces of possession. But that stuff doesn't, you know, at the time, of course, being laughable to me, I can't imagine it staying with me. But it's not things that haunted me. It's things that startled me. And if you want a startling film, then The Exorcist is great for you. If you want a collection of, you know, people like sneaking up behind you, that's all right. But that's not what I was hoping to gain from this film. I was hoping to gain a bunch of things that really stayed with me and haunted me and fucked me up. I wanted this movie to fuck me up. I mean, movies that truly terrify you are movies that eliminate your sense of safety. That is a surefire way to make a film that will disturb people. And we have far too much an element of safety here, and not even one that they instill just to give you a false sense of safety. I mean, what I'm talking about is this room, right? Everything that's scary that happens is pretty much in this girl's room, or at least when she's on screen. And if we're not in the room, if we're not going up to the room, if sounds aren't coming from the room, then there's nothing frightening. Everybody's safe. You have this overwhelming sense of safety, and you know where the danger's at. And there's no real danger for any of these characters unless they involve themselves in the room. And I mean, we're talking about the devil on earth. There really should be some greater sense of danger here, and there just isn't.
Yeah.
When we go in the room, we're going to get something unexpected or startling. And when we begin to expect to see things that are unexpected, by definition, we're ruining that surprise for ourselves. I mean, I would understand this idea that they've built up with the room and that being what's scary and everything outside being safe if they betrayed that safety. Because having safety and then betraying it is a great theme that a lot of horror movies hit on, and I think that usually really works. That's something you can really make work. The only disturbing theme that this movie hits on is possession, which admittedly, like, I don't believe in possession, so maybe that's part of the reason it doesn't really get to me. But I think you could make it work in a film. You definitely could make that work.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea that you could lose control of your body and your mind and your soul should be absolutely terrifying. And the movie just doesn't play with this enough. I mean, none of the other characters are ever afraid of possession to themselves. And the end of the movie, which I'll touch on later, even seems to suggest that the audience shouldn't be afraid of it either. So the things that horrified people, you know, back in the day when they saw this, and apparently still horrify people, whatever that means. But first of all, creepy kids, which I think that's cheap too. And people will argue with me about that, that creepy kids are like legitimate in film and whatever. So you have this kid that's possessed and, you know, the Freddy movies rely on this a lot, and you see this a lot in film. Kids who talk backwards or, you know, whatever. I don't buy the creepy kid. I think it's a little too easy, but whatever. Take it or leave it. So you have this kid who, she says a lot of vulgar things. She's possessed. You find out it's by the devil, whatever. And you get this really strange, convoluted story. And let me just throw out this disclaimer right now, okay? Atheist rambling here. Don't believe in the afterlife. Maybe that had something to do with the reason it, like, didn't haunt my dreams, because I had this awakening when I kind of like figured out there was no God, that suddenly I wasn't afraid of ghosts anymore, which is a wonderful little side effect of not believing in an afterlife. None of that shit sticks with me ever at all. And maybe that really bothers people who like are religious or spiritual or whatever. Doesn't get to me.
I find it difficult to believe, though, that a theater full of people who watch 24 hours of horror movies are all spiritual, religious people.
Yeah.
Especially when it ends at noon on Sunday.
Yeah, right. Exactly. No one is watching The Exorcist.
And then headed off to church.
Yeah. That doesn't make any sense. You know, so I'm thinking maybe it's a camp element, and I'm seeing, you know, I wish you would have seen the theater's response to this stuff, because it made me feel bad about Jack Brooks. There were particular moments in the film that I kind of knew just from artwork and from, you know, this being an element of culture, that would come up in the film and people would cheer. They would applaud. So you have when Max shows up, our main exorcist, you know, with the guy they bring in later. And as soon as Max gets screen time, you know, when he comes into the film, I don't know, 2/3 in or whatever, the audience is really applauded. This is the guy from such classics as Judge Dredd and, you know, Rush Hour 3. I pick on him. He's done all right stuff. Whatever. Let's leave that alone. He shows up. He's this character that's pretty much just kind of added 2/3 of the way through the film. Once the bulk of this film, which everyone remembers being the exorcism stuff, I mean, that's kind of just tacked on at the end here. and we go through what seems to me to be the like a level of camp that is Buffy the Vampire Slayer to me. It is, hey, let's go through some holy water. Let's like rub some garlic on this chick. Let's see what we can do here. It's reading lots of Bible passages really frantically. And none of that builds a climax for me. And I mean, that's supposed to be our climax of the film here. And so we reach the end of this thing. And this is going to be the end of the show, right? So I just got to, the ending is the thing that bothers me the most. I can overlook a lot of these things. I can overlook the atrocities that appeared in the revision of this film for 2000. I can overlook convoluted story with characters I really don't give a shit about. I can overlook a lot of these scare shots that happened that I found predictable, and a lot of these iconic images that really didn't do anything for me. I can overlook all of that. We get to the ending of this film. If you care about the ending of The Exorcist, yeah, doublefeature.com, whatever, leave, bye. Okay, good talking to you. The ending of this film, the feel-good ending of this, right, is one of the priests gets like a heart attack, right? He dies because of something unseen, which is maybe the only clever thing in this entire film, is that there's some big traumatic event that kills off, you know, our hero here in a very feast kind of style, and we just don't know what it is. And okay, that's kind of creepy. And then our other protagonist goes in, and he sacrifices himself. Martyrdom here, right? Are you familiar with the theme of martyrdom? Because it's apparently a classic theme that goes back to...
It's where you kill yourself because of a ghost cult, right?
right. Exactly what it is. So to get the demon out of this little girl who's possessed by the devil, the fucking devil, the most evil man of all time, you know, like fucking shiny little pitchfork pokes you in the tuchus. All right, this guy, right? The little ears, little horn things going on here. The devil himself. He's like
Satan, right?
Yeah, he compels the devil with the power of Christ to leave this girl's body and take him instead. He sacrifices himself for this girl. Here's why this is a problem for me. So then you get this iconic scene. He throws himself out the window. You know, the devil has possessed him. He's gonna fucking one up that devil. He'll show him, and he leaps out the window and falls down the infamous flight of stairs, and that's, you know, that's the end of him. Here's the problem with that. I don't know if they read the rule book to this, because they set this up in Catholic mythology. And I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and even say Christian mythology here. Just broad spectrum. Same problem we saw in films like Constantine, which is why when you're pulling the same problems as Constantine, you know, that's where
classic
you have,
film, man.
Yeah, that's where you have problems, mm-hmm. Right? It's the fucking devil. Like let me launch into this in a way that's as coherent as I can possibly make it without just being like, the devil can possess anyone he wants at any given time. He can possess multiple people. He's the fucking devil. And, you know, I could even overlook this, but they set it up in the film by not telling you, you know, in a very like kind of hide the monster way, not telling you why she's possessed, that maybe something traumatic happened to her and as a result she's been possessed, but they give you that rule. The film even gives you the rule that, of course, Catholicism gives you as well, in this kind of mythology, that the devil can possess anyone at any time in any place. That's the scary thing, right? That's the psychologically thrilling thing. So the devil jumps out of the girl into him, right? Jumps into his mouth and sucks into his spirit and his soul. And before the possession takes full force, he kills himself. That doesn't kill the fucking devil. It's the devil. Like, then we get this ending of the film where she rides away all happy. You know, 3 minutes after we see the credits, she could be repossessed by the devil. It's the fucking devil. We don't know why he was... Let's treat the devil as a character in a film and not like a supernaturally spooky thing that like creeps people out. Not a excuse for them to make her head spin and her vomit.
Let's pretend it's Peter Stormare.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So the devil is a character. We don't know why he showed up, but we know he has the power to possess at any point, and he is the story of this film. This is the overarching story in this film, is that we have possession. We need to get rid of possession. It's the simplest plot of all time. And at the ending of the film, you get a feeling that you've gotten rid of possession, but hello, it's the fucking devil. There's no closure there. And there's ways they could have provided closure, or ways they could have left out closure but pointed to it and been like, look, that's the creepy thing, right? Is you can never have closure. But they don't. They give you this pat on the back ending like, good thing we cleaned up that job. Great. Everybody go home. We fixed it.
That's why there's two sequels and a prequel, man.
No more devil. Well, and there's like 30 films in this fucking awful franchise and spin-offs and made-for-TV movies and blaxploitation based on it. And I mean, because it's a joke, right? It's an absolute fucking joke. I just do not understand how you could treat this as... This isn't a campy film. This is a classic piece of iconic cinema history. It probably fits in the like AFI top 100 fucking whatever. And I don't understand how you can get away with this. I laughed at the ending of this film. I mean, the person I was watching this film laughed at the ending of this film. We walked away going, like, what happened here? And everyone else, like, stood and applauded.
So what you're saying is give The Exorcist a chance because it's actually probably a really good film?
No, this okay. is an atrocity, and there's no reason you need to see this.
Is give Dead Alive a chance because it's one of the greatest films ever made.
Good. I'm glad we brought that back around. It's the fucking devil. The Exorcist, all right, that's it. That's all I got.
The Exorcist needs more lawnmowers.
Hey, this is Joel David Moore from your favorite movie, Hatchet. Join the Hatchet Army. Listen to Double Feature.
Okay, so it's been an entire year, and surprisingly, the Sarah Palin jokes still work even
poignant,
today.
Potent.
Yeah. So above all other things, I think what we can say is that Music Box Massacre 4 was a really fucking fun time.
We spent, in the show, we spent too much time talking. Like, honestly, I know this is going to come off weird because you're listening to Double Feature with Eric and Michael here, but we spent too much time talking about film and not enough time talking about how fucking fun it was.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, you know, it was the first time that I've ever done one of these. I think, did you say that you'd been to Massacre before? Was this your first one too?
It was my Massacre cherry.
All right, so this is the plan for number 5, and okay, hopefully you're listening to this before number 5. The plan is don't get there early, because everybody gets there early.
Yeah.
We thought we were going to get a heads up. Don't bother doing that. Bring a lot of fucking food, because you're going to be starving.
So they say they have energy drinks and food there. That runs out by 4 p.m.
Yeah, by like the third film. Yeah, if that.
It's because it's everybody going, well, if it's going to run, I better get some now. And that's why everybody died during Phantom of the Paradise.
Well, you have to remember what happens. You have to remember what kind of group of people this is. These are people who show up early to a film. So almost everybody kind of shows up at the same time, except the people who trickle in late in the day. That's not to say if you can't watch, you know, all 24 hours of this, you should probably still show up and watch like the last half or the first half or
the middle half.
Yeah. So anything before we get into the stuff that's actually coming up this year at Music Box Massacre 5, let's look back at 4 for a second.
Yeah.
It's been a year, and our entire last year of show was concerned with how you thought about films after you'd seen them, you know, a while back.
All right. Well, basically, most of my opinions have stayed the same. I still think Joseph Zito's a dick.
Right.
But I now can officially say, and humbly so, that I own The Midnight Meat Train.
Yeah.
And that I was too hard on it when we were watching it the first time. It's still, I'm not saying it's a fantastic endeavor of film, but it's definitely a film you should see. It's just, it's got a flaw. It's flawed, but you know, like, There are films that are more greatly flawed than Midnight Meat Train that don't have nearly as much like gorgeous blood. We talk about how much we like the first part of the film, but I don't think we stress how good the first part of the film is.
Well, it's because you get fucking bitch slapped with what happens in that film, and then it's all you can think about. Once you have some time to step away from the, you know, the crazy shit that happened, it's like you're having a good day and all of a sudden there's like a traumatic accident.
Yeah.
So you never think about what happened up to that point.
Exactly.
You're just like, what the fuck was that about? So now it's a year later and we can kind of look back at that. That's one of the reasons I really wanted you to listen to that, because I feel like, you know, even just mixing it and stuff, it's kind of going, wow, that's not how I feel about that film at all. Yeah. I still don't give a shit about The Exorcist.
Right.
I think it's a terrible film. I'm not nearly that critical about any film we ever do on the show anymore.
I wish we had given The Old Dark House more time.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, what is it? Do you want a potato? Have more potatoes.
Yeah, The Old Dark House was a really good time and something that definitely grew on me. I still, unfortunately, have not seen Black Sabbath again.
Yeah.
I really mean to, because I just giggled the entire way through.
I'm still
This is the other thing kind of about our show that I thought was weird, is our show used to be a lot more about strange shit that happened to us as we were watching films, whereas now it's about the films themselves. We spent like half of that episode talking about sleep deliria, which that was kind of interesting.
I'd rather hear about sleep deliria than Phantom of the Paradise.
So you're still not digging Phantom of the Paradise?
Not so much.
We met this girl at Music Box Massacre about a year ago.
Yeah.
She really likes Phantom of the Paradise.
Really?
Yeah. And she's kind of still around, and she still tells me to see Phantom of the Paradise all the time, and that it's a great film.
Like as we've already kind of admitted, we were too hard on the films.
Yeah.
Maybe Phantom of the
Paradise. Does that include Phantom of the Paradise? That doesn't include The Exorcist. I'm going to say right now,
we were too hard on Phantom of the Paradise. I'm not saying it was good, but I'm just gauging, like, judging by the caliber of this production, I doubt any of the films were really horrible.
Right, sure.
It's just by comparison to something like Dead Alive,
something like Jack Brooks,
right.
something like May, some of the films are going to fall.
Phantom of the Paradise kind of seemed like, how the hell was that there?
Right? Yeah, you know, it's like...
It also seemed like, why is everyone dressed up?
It's like when you go see a band...
It's like when you go to see Nine Inch Nails and Street Sweeper Social Club is
playing.
Yeah,
it's exactly like that.
That's sort of what's going on there. One thing I kind of want to look at is these slasher films. You know, I remember when we did... The original Jason Killapalooza.
Killapalooza number one.
We made fun of the fourth Jason a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I will still make fun of the fourth Jason, but I don't want people to misconstrue it as I hate the film because that was probably the film I would have picked for the Massacre.
Sure.
And you'll see that again. This is a great segue into the stuff that's coming up on 5. Because on Music Box Massacre 5, which slasher film are we seeing?
Oh my God. Nomland itself.
Yeah.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 is, I guess the phrase we've been throwing around is, wonderful failure? Is
wonderful
it fantastic failure?
Fantastic failure.
I can't even call it one of the worst because it's so much fun.
Yeah.
But we rallied against it on that Killapalooza. It's not the best Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie, but at a 24-hour, like, basically horror convention, this is the film that you're going to want to watch.
Mm-hmm.
It is absolutely crazy. It makes no sense. It's off the deep end. You know what I
Dennis
mean?
Dennis Hopper double wielding chainsaws screaming, bring it down for not kidding 30 minutes of the film.
Yeah, for the last half of the film, really. It's just a really good watch. So if you haven't seen it yet, see it. And you know what? If you've already seen it, you should probably sandwich it in these other films. I'm going to, this is all live because I don't want to mix anymore this week. I'm going to slide you this laptop here. Why don't you read me the films that are coming up on 5?
That's because you're going to say Notre Dame, right? Coming up for Music Box Massacre number 5.
Which is October 10th.
Which will be October 10th.
Buy a goddamn ticket or play along at home.
Next year?
Yeah, I think we're going to put it up next year.
Okay, so if you don't have time to see these shows on October 10th, we'll give you a year.
Oh, yeah, it doesn't matter when it is, right? Because we're not even going to talk about this till next year. Right.
But the films that you can go see are The Hunchback of Notre Dame, the original from like the 20s, right?
Right, right.
Then we have Isle of the Dead.
It's just always the original, right?
Just bet on original.
Yeah.
Isle of the Dead, Bucket of Blood, Stuart Gordon's The Black Cat, which is one of his newer films.
Stuart Gordon's going to be there, right?
Mm-hmm. And then we have, I didn't know this was going to be there. The Brood by David Cronenberg.
Oh, you didn't see that?
Heyo.
Yeah, so hopefully this will not be our first Cronenberg movie by the time we air this next year. We want to get, both you and I like Cronenberg quite a bit. So we just haven't found a good person to pair him with.
Yeah.
And I'm really hoping I can get you to pair him with some David Lynch because I think that'd be a really good conversation.
Possible.
All right, cool.
Then looks like we have a double pairing of more Stuart Gordon.
Yeah.
With Reanimator.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I haven't seen that yet. I'm really excited
and
about it.
From Beyond.
Yeah.
And then this is the premiere of Pontypool.
Yeah.
In the Midwest.
No idea what that is.
Then the 81 film Dark Knight of the Scarecrow.
Mm-hmm.
Then at, this is at 4:20 in the morning.
Jesus.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2.
That's when you want to, I didn't realize that was so late in the morning.
And then
there's no way we're going to even be conscious for that, right?
Then there's
that's going to be fucking
then
insane.
It's Herschel Gordon Lewis's Blood Feast,
the
king of gore,
right?
Really, like that's where it came from.
Yeah,
Stephen King's Maximum Overdrive, in which machines take over the earth.
Yeah.
Oh, Stephen King.
If you glory. So, even if you don't give a shit about Music Box Massacre 5, go on the website musicboxtheater.com and look at the thumbnail for that film. That's all I have to say about that.
And finally, we have Stephen King done right with the Sissy Spacek version of Carrie, top off the entire 24-hour massacre.
All right, that's a lot of films, but none of those are films that we're doing next time on
the
show.
In fact, we're going to do two different films.
We hope to see people. I don't think we've stressed this enough. Go to the massacre if you live in the Midwest. It's awesome. There's still tickets. You know, feel free to say hi. We'll be the two people applauding during Death Curse. So
yes.
That's how you'll know it's us. There's also going to be a lot of booths and stuff there. If you're into horror, if you're into camp, if you're into, cheap movies, really $30 for what, a million films,
12 or 13 films.
Oh, and they're going to do the trailers thing again. Yep. I'm sure they'll probably have some
probably
shorts,
see Mad Max at least 40 times like
right.
last year.
Maybe some animated stuff in there. So it like talk about fucking Grindhouse. That's going to be a really good time. What are we doing on this goddamn show coming up next?
Next episode of Double Feature, Escape from New York, paired against Religious.
Okay, so what are we doing with this whole escape thing? Because there's two of those movies,
right? In an attempt to skirt a false dichotomy, we're going to do Escape from New York with Religulous, and then we're going to do Escape from L.A. with Expelled.
Well, that sounds dangerous.
Incredibly dangerous.
All right, but well, we don't want to put people through another quote-unquote grindhouse experience by making them do both escape movies back-to-back, right?
That's not the other thing that we don't want to do is spread them out like our Terminator Prophecy experiment.
Yeah, that was bad. And then, you know, Religulous and Expelled, here's the thing, is both of those are at the very least going to involve some Jesus, and we haven't had any Jesus on the show yet. Well, we always have Jesus on the show.
Yeah,
Jesus He's always with you with in us. Your heart, right? Yeah. I knew one of us was going to make that awful joke. God, I have to edit these shows. That'll get some more good old-fashioned Jesus bashing on our show. So we have a website, doublefeatureshow.com. We also have an email address where you can tell us that you hate when we talk about events that are only local to Chicago that you don't give a fuck about. That's doublefeatureshow@gmail.com. If you email us that, we're just going to delete it. What you should do is put it up in a public place where everybody could read that. Do you have any of those in mind? Or
iTunes.
Yeah, iTunes would be a good one. You could just leave us a little comment. iTunes moderates those. We don't. So if you say something mean about Music Box Massacre, everyone will get to read it, and you will be a greater internet dickwad. And
so fuck you and watch more fucking film.
Goodbye.